Hi, this is Mary Angela Perna, and welcome to Mary's Place Media, formerly Lush Left Media. I am thrilled. I have on today's program David Shore. He's an American data scientist known for analyzing political polls. He currently serves as the head of data science with Open Labs, a progressive nonprofit, and he currently serves as a senior fellow at the Center for American Progress Action Fund. He was recently on Bill Maher's show and Morning Joe. Welcome to the program, David.
Pleasure to be here.
So, you have making a round, and I saw you on Morning Joe, and I thought you had some really great analysis as far as, like, how Democrats, you know, what they're doing right, what they're doing wrong. You analyze polls, you analyze things, and we need that right now. And what would you say, what kind of struck me here is, well, one, you're talking about, like, messaging. I saw a tweet of yours, you were talking about, like say, defund the police. What are some issues that you think the Democrats, and it's a big tent, so you have, like, kind of, I call it just for shorthand, like the Bernie or the, you know, the activist part of the tent, and then you have, you know, more the moderate wing. What are we doing wrong? What are we doing right as far as, like, things like, say, defund the police?
Well, you know, rather than try to blame, you know, one faction or another, I think it's worth stepping back and seeing the big picture of what people trust Democrats on and what people trust Republicans on. You know, this is something right. that I think has actually really been constant throughout history, and it's really constant, you know, if you look throughout the developed world, where generally speaking, people trust the center-left on issues like healthcare, like education, like improving the economic situation for the middle class, decreasing unemployment. But the flip side is that people really trust conservatives on issues like crime, immigration, guns, and keeping the economy moving. And so, you know, the job of a political party is to try to keep the national conversation on a topic or a piece of the issue space where voters agree with them and trust them, and keep it away from a place where they don't, you know, trust them. And, you know, one of the things that trips us up, you know, I think, is that a lot of people, you know, on the left, but really throughout the party, really want to talk about issues that they care a lot about. It's a very natural thing. You know, they'll want to talk about guns, they'll want to talk about immigration, they'll want to talk about, you know, expansive changes to the welfare state that involve large tax increases. And, you know, the problem is that, you know, shifts things to the issue space, to a part of the issue space where Republicans have a natural advantage. I think that points to, like, a really clear strategy, which is that in order to win elections, you should talk about broadly popular things that the public cares about and agrees with you on, using language that people can understand. And that sounds, you know, that sounds obvious when you actually say it, but I think actually carrying through it ends up being very radical. If Democrats did that consistently, they would run very different campaigns, and we'd have a very different media ecosystem than we currently have right now.
No, but do you think I interview candidates. Don't you think that messaging or, you know, what I hear what you're saying, but that's for specific, like one district's not going to be the same as another district. Correct?
So, you know, I'd push back on a little bit. You know, I mean, it's true that not all districts are the same. Some districts are much more liberal than other districts. And so if you are Ilhan Omar, you can underperform Joe Biden by 12% or whatever the number was, it was very large, and still win. And so that part is still true. But I do think one of the big overriding stories of American politics is that there's been a decreasing amount of ticket splitting and an increasing amount of polarization. And, you know, what I mean by that is just that the correlation between presidential vote share and House vote share or Senate vote share is just much higher than it used to be. You know, going back to, like, you know, even 2012, someone like Heidi Heitkamp was able to win in a state like North Dakota in an open race and outperform Obama by 14 or 15 points. And that kind of thing just isn't possible anymore. You know, the correlation between House vote and presidential vote is almost twice as large as it was 20 years ago. And so I think that, you know, we're no longer at the place where a candidate can go in and distance themselves from the party with, like, the right positioning or the right words and win. You know, at this point, voters correctly see all parties, all Democrats as part of the same blob. And I think that means that, you know, we no longer can live in this world where we campaign in some districts like this and in some districts like this. You know, we really need a unified strategy that appeals to swing voters everywhere. Like, if we want to win in relatively conservative districts, it's actually really damaging for really anyone in the movement to be pushing really unpopular ideas like defund the police.
Right. Can we talk? You mentioned immigration real quick. So as you know, after the 2012 loss for Romney, there was the famous autopsy in the Republican Party, which was sort of a move towards working with Democrats to do some practical good immigration reform. Well, Trump obviously, and I can include, you know, Bannon, and I can include Jeff Sessions, I can include Stephen Miller, you know, that whole kind of Breitbart faction, really Ann Coulter, they really kind of pushed things to where it's a national, in my view, this is just me talking, closed borders, essentially. Where do Democrats, and now, you know, this all, you know, some people are calling it a quote crisis right now, it's happening with the border now under Joe Biden. What is a happy medium here? I know it's a big question, but I'm confused myself.
Yeah, you know, I think the point of winning elections, you know, is to do things. And if you're in a position where you can help people from a humanitarian perspective, you know, you should. But I think we should be clear-eyed about the political challenges here. Immigration has, in test after test that I've done, been basically the most effective attack that Republicans can give against Democrats. And, you know, I think it's one of the issues where voters really trust Republicans a lot more than Democrats. And, you know, the reality is that the public is very skeptical, you know, of the Democratic vision of increasing the amount of immigration that comes into this country. You know, I think people, if you look at polling, even though people are sympathetic to the idea of creating some kind of normalized status, most of the country doesn't actually support, you know, giving undocumented immigrants citizenship. Even among Hispanics, only about 54% of Hispanics pick citizenship as an option, you know, out of the three. And so it is a big political liability for Democrats. And I think that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do, you know, liberal things on immigration, but I think it does mean that we have to do everything we can to not talk about it and keep the media from talking about it. You know, in some ways, I really hate the analogy I'm about to make, but, you know, I think that Republicans are very smart in that there are very unpopular parts of their agenda that they know are unpopular. They know that if they went out and campaigned on saying, I want to cut taxes on rich people, I want to get rid of the estate tax, I want to make it easier to pollute rivers, they know that that's not popular. And if they did that, they would lose elections. And Mitt Romney did this, and he lost. He made he made his RNC a loving, you know, like a love song about small business owners, and that didn't appeal, you know, to working class people. But, you know, I think the problem is that Democrats don't realize that the unpopular parts of our agenda are unpopular because they feel very strongly. And I think, you know, in the same way that I think Republican intellectuals very legitimately believe that cutting taxes on super rich people will unleash economic growth and make everyone better off, you know, people in the Democratic Party understand, you know, myself included, that there's a giant humanitarian crisis and that normalizing the status of millions of people would be a big, you know, utilitarian win. They know, you know, we all intuitively believe that this country would be better if we can bring in more immigrants into the country. But the median voter doesn't agree with us. And to the extent, and the more we talk about it, the worse we're going to do. And you know, this gets to my real theory of politics, which is that, or it's not my theory. I think it's how politics works. Is that the more we talk about the things that people agree with us on, and that's things like healthcare, things like education, things like you know, creating jobs for people, the better we'll do. And I think that there's great evidence of this. You know, if you look at Joe Biden's polling, he's the first president, you know, in history to not see a decline in his approval rating over the course of the first month of the election. That's literally never happened before. And I think it's because it's literally never happened. And I think the reason that happened was exactly because he pushed an extremely popular economic recovery plan. You know, we pulled over 100 different policies in the last 3 months, and his plan was the single most popular thing that we've ever pulled. And so as a result, you know, his approval rating has held steady. But now that immigration is coming up in salience, you know, we're starting to see that approval decline. And I think it just shows that this is a very dangerous issue for Democrats. And I think on top of that, you know, the thing that makes it even worse is that immigration has become a lot less popular. You know, I think one of the really underrated aspects of political science, it's a very robust political science finding, but one that the public doesn't know about, is something called thermostatic public opinion. It has a terrible name. But the basic idea is that whenever the president advocates for a policy, it makes that policy less popular, not more popular, because people tend to react against the party in power. And so when Barack Obama, you know, did a big healthcare push, universal healthcare became less popular. When Donald Trump was very against immigration, immigration became more popular. And now that Joe Biden is in power, people are turning against the Democratic position on immigration. I think there's been like a 10 to 15% swing in the last 3 months since the inauguration. And so I think it's just important, you know, to remember, you know, that all of these, whenever we look at polling, the public is going to turn against liberal ideas, just like they did under Obama, just like they did under Clinton, and just like they've done under basically every Democratic president. And that means that we need to stick to the most popular parts of our agenda in order for us to keep campaigning on things that are above 50. And that's essential, because if we don't, if Joe Biden's approval rating isn't above 50 or 51%, you know, on election day, we will almost certainly lose the House. We will almost certainly lose the Senate, and we will be locked out of power for potentially a very long time. And so, you know, the stakes to having message discipline are very high right now. And I think it's important that we remember that and be clear-eyed about what our strengths and weaknesses are.
Well, I'll end with this, because I know that you're super busy and I don't want to keep you, but speaking of an issue that's definitely going to come up is healthcare. And as you know, and I was definitely a part of this, but I'm for strategy. So as far as like, say, Medicare for all on the more of the left wing of the party, how does Joe Biden navigate, say, the left activist wing of the party, the Bernie left to shorthand, and also expand healthcare for people? Like, what would you, in the work that you do and the polls you're seeing, et cetera, say about something like Medicare for All?
Yeah, you know, Medicare for All is very interesting in that if you just go and you, first, Democrats do trust, people trust Democrats more on healthcare than they trust Republicans. And I think if you just do a survey and you ask people, do you think that the government should give people healthcare? For the most part, they say yes. It depends exactly how you word the poll. But it's, you know, it looks like a broadly popular thing. You know, the problem with Medicare for All is that in order to realistically implement it, you need pretty large tax increases. And once you do that, once you propose a healthcare policy that involves really large tax increases, you move things from the healthcare space where Democrats are advantaged to the taxes space where Republicans are advantaged. And it ends up being a big liability. You know, if you actually comprehensively poll Medicare for All in an informed ballot where you give pro and con arguments and you list how expensive it is, it becomes one of the more unpopular parts of the Democratic policy agenda. And, you know, obviously polling is hard. You can poll things in different ways and get different results. But I think that there's a really clear story that every place where it's been tried. You know, in Vermont, there was a Democratic governor who tried to pass single payer and then almost lost re-election in 2014, then retired in disgrace, and Republicans actually, is now a Republican governor in Vermont. There have been attempts to pass single payer at the ballot box in Colorado, and it got only 30%. And I think that in the Democratic primary, multiple candidates, that came out for Medicare for All, I think it was one of the most defining issues in the primary, and something that came through very clearly was that candidates who came out for it really suffered. Buttigieg saw a meteoric rise just because he was one of the only people under the age of 70 to say that he didn't want Medicare for All. I personally am for single payer in an abstract sense.
I'm the same, but I just want to get it, how can we get there, as far as strategy?
Yeah, and I think that in practice, and just the last piece of evidence is, there have been a lot of candidates who have endorsed Medicare for All, and in the House, if you do a multivariate regression analysis, coming out in favor of Medicare for All seems like it costs you something like 1-2%, which is a lot, right, given how polarized things are. I think when it comes to healthcare, I think that the approach that people have put out in terms of creating a strong public option that can transition people, I think is really good in that it avoids tax increases because it's an accounting gimmick that, classifies premium. You call it premiums instead of taxes, but I think it really does have a really big mm-hmm. effect in how you do things. I think it's voluntary. I think this is an underrated part of the issue with Medicare for All, which is that people are really averse to the idea of being forced onto a plan. People really
right.
like the option of buying into a plan. I think a lot of people are, I think there's a real, the social trust is a lot lower than it used to be. People don't have very much faith in government. They don't have very much faith in institutions. And, I think a lot of people will say, if the government can't even set up a health insurance website, how are they supposed to run 10% of the economy?
Do you think something like a public option, it would be more effective than, say, Medicare for All?
From a political perspective, I did some polling with Data for Progress, which is a left-wing think tank, and we found that Medicare buy-in, basically creating a strong public option, was very popular and something that had support in, I think, the vast majority, I think something like 260 House districts, but single payer did not. Single payer was something like 10 to 15% less popular than Medicare buy-in. And even among Democratic primary electorate, the Democratic primary electorate was roughly 50-50 split between buy-in and Medicare for All. So when you look at swing voters, I think there's a clear case. I think that a strong public option gets you most of the benefits of Medicare for All, but with much less of a political cost. And that's why, I'm really happy that the party has coalesced around it. I don't think Joe Biden's plan that he campaigned on goes as far. I like Buttigieg's a lot more, but, I do think it carries a lot less political risk.
Yeah, it sounds like from what you're saying that, we can't just look at areas that are really blue. You're talking about like trying to get the support of the country if you're the president. And messaging is, how do I articulate this? If you give people the option, if people have a choice, they don't feel like they're, I think that's kind of what you've discovered, or someone like Sean McAwee of Data for Progress, is that what you're saying, that It just is a better sell, I guess, is what I'm.
I think it's a better sell, and I also think that it really is very similar in terms of outcomes. Like ultimately, what we should care about is getting people access to affordable health care. I think the public agrees with us on that goal, and so the question is, how do we do that without explicit large middle class tax increases and without forcing people to go into a plan that they don't want? I think there are very reasonable critiques with, both of those points, but I think that we have to realize that is what voters want. And I think that there's a lot to work with there to successfully accomplish shared goals that we have and that the median voter has. And it's a problem that we should take really seriously.
So one last question. Do you think, from what you're saying, it's early in the process. I've only interviewed like one candidate so far. I mean, we're super early still. But I'm concerned. I'm looking at that MAGA bench. I belong to all the lists. I get every email. I get them all, right? I just got one just before we start talking, and they're already have their hit list out, you know, the whole kind of MAGA America First world of the Republican Party. And they are going to primary all of them, you know, the Adamkins and all of them that didn't fully support Trump, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, aren't, you know, America First, whatever that means, you know, strong closed borders, the whole bit, right? And I have to be honest, I mean, I'm wondering, like, you know, okay, if they're going to the right, this kind of MAGA movement, what's the best way to characterize this? If they're kind of going to the right, into this like kind of nationalist right, what kind of candidates do we run, and how do we get everyone, you know, again, you know, the left is like herding cats. I know you've heard of that phrase, but I just don't, who do we run in these areas where they're like, you know, they're going to run these full on kind of like almost nationalist type candidates? What are your thoughts?
Yeah, you know, I think the danger is that, you know, a lot of these nationalist candidates, these Trumpy candidates, in some ways are more electable. Not than Adam Kinzinger, but you know, Trump, I think this is an underappreciated aspect of Donald Trump's success, is that Trump was seen as one of the most moderate people to ever run for president. He was seen as substantially more moderate than Hillary Clinton was, and the reason is the issues that he took. You know, a lot of his rhetoric really, really disgusted highly educated people. But if you look at what he actually said, he took the position that we should not have cuts to Medicare and Social Security, and that immigration levels should be lower. And that is a viewpoint that nearly a majority of the American public believed, but that wasn't being represented by everyone in the space. It was something that educated people don't believe, and that's why politicians who are overwhelmingly educated didn't take that position, but he did, and as a result, he was seen as moderate. And that's the thing I find really scary about this nationalist turn by the Republican Party, is that what they're doing in practice is decreasing their emphasis on the really unpopular parts of conservatism, namely, you know, giving a bunch of money away to rich people and, you know, trying to cut benefits to middle class and poor people. They do it, but you know what they are doing. But in practice, what Trumpism is replacing the rhetorical emphasis on economic conservatism with a culture war against highly educated people. And I think it is hating highly educated people is much more popular than wanting to cut taxes on billionaires. And so I find it all very concerning that that's the direction they're going in. I think a lot of liberals kind of salivate, you know, at the idea of running against these nationalists. But I think, you know, nationalism is very powerful. And so I think that the only way to combat something like that is to neutralize these nationalist dimensions by running candidates who don't trigger cultural conservatives and trigger this kind of cultural backlash. You know, Democrats win when the election is a referendum on healthcare or a referendum on, you know, economic policies that impact people, people's lives and help people's lives. And Democrats lose when we have a culture war about the desirability of the liberal inclusive vision of the world. And so that, I'll just like close out by saying that one of the big things that I hear people say in American politics is that people care. Democrats talk too much about issues, we're too wonky, we need to communicate our values. And I think the actual problem is that our values are weird and alien to the median voter. People only vote for us because they agree with us on concrete things. And so if we're going to run against these nationalist candidates, our only hope at winning is to nominate candidates who don't talk about these issues that make people want to vote for Donald Trump and talk about the issues that make people want to vote for Democrats. And I think the stakes are really high because in a way that wasn't true when we were running against Mitt Romney, these Trumpy Republicans are legitimately hostile to democracy in a way that, you know, we haven't seen in American politics for a long time. And so this is the thing that bugs me. Is I think a lot of Democrats will on one hand say, Republicans are an existential threat to our democracy, and I agree with that. But then at the next step, they'll say, we cannot compromise on immigration or guns or Medicare for all. And I think the answer is that not everything can be equally important. If you really take seriously that we are at risk of losing our democracy, that means that it is imperative, you know, for us to have message discipline and ideological constraint so that we can prevent democratic white sliding into permanent, you know, white majority minority rule.
I could not agree with you more, and that's why I brought you on, and you're a nice guy and you're smart. All right, well, where can people find you? You are just such an important voice, in my opinion. Where can people find you?
Thank you. Thank you so much. I'm David Schor on Twitter. S-H-O-R is my last name. I'd love to hear from anyone. My DMs are open.
All right, you're the best. Thank you so much, and I hope to have you back on soon. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Take care. Bye.